Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The new novel from Stephen Graham Jones is a tale of revenge, trauma, and tradition. The book is titled The Only Good Indians, and the story follows four Blackfeet men who find themselves haunted by a mysterious and dangerous being bent on revenge for a disrespectful act the men committed 10 years ago. It is spine-chilling and elegantly gory. Take, for example, this description of the creature appearing in one of its forms. Her face, her head. She arches back, her fingers deep in the meat and muscle of her shoulder, and her face is elongating from the strain. Her cheeks and chin tear with a wet sound, and the bones crunch, resettling. At the end of it, her long hair is blowing away from her, isn't connected to her scalp anymore. And her face, it's not a horse, an elk. Elk head woman. Publishers Weekly said of The Only Good Indians, this novel works both as a terrifying chiller and as biting commentary on the existential crisis of indigenous peoples adapting to a culture that is bent on eradicating theirs. Joining me now is author Stephen Graham Jones. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Stephen, there are these two avenues that to follow in the book. There's the actual horror, scary stuff. And then there's this very interesting and sly way you subvert expectations about indigenous people, but also explore the lives of indigenous people. So I'm curious, how is horror a good way to get into some of those issues that you wanted to explore?
You know, in horror, really in all of fiction, it's in the most intense moments that we know the character best. So horror is just chock full with intense moments. And mm-hmm. I think that allows us like immediate access to who people are.
Well, let's talk about who the folks are. The four guys who are being haunted and then ultimately sort of hunted themselves, Ricky, Lewis, Cassidy, and Gabe. Tell us a little bit about each. Let's start with Ricky.
Ricky, he's a big old guy. He can grow like a really wispy Indian beard. He is always a manual laborer, which is what I've always been, so he was an easy guy to write. And Ricky, his little brother Cheeto overdosed on a couch, someone's couch. And, you know, that actually, talking about that, I didn't even think about that until I was talking about Cheeto. I was riding an elevator in Bozeman, Montana, and a dude got on. We were going up to the fourth floor or something together, and we got to talking, and turns out he's from Browning, and one of my cousins had died on a couch that he knew, and so that to me was kind of where I got Cheeto from. But Ricky's little brother Cheeto is he's orange haired, he's pale skinned, and I mean, he's still Indian, but he kind of has it rough on the reservation because of his orange hair and his pale skin, you know.
What about Lewis?
Lewis is living off reservation. Mm-hmm. He's married to a white woman. He's about 2 hours off the reservation in Great Falls. He works at the post office, so he's working for the federal government. He's always tinkering on his bike in the garage. He's got a dog he likes.
And Cassidy and Gabe.
Cassidy and Gabe have stayed home. They've stayed around Browning. Cassidy is engaged to be married after, you know, kind of a wild time growing up. And Gabe has never let go of being 17 years old. He's still living like he's 17, mm-hmm. even though he's 36.
So it's on the surface, these four men shot a herd of elk on elder land. So on the surface, mm-hmm. it's wrong and it's disrespectful to the elders. But there's also a deeper crime, one that provokes revenge from the creature. What is it?
You know, it's really, to me, it's that these four men out on what they consider to be their last day of the hunt 10 years ago, right before Thanksgiving, they kind of think that all bets are off, mm-hmm. that anything that fills their freezer is the right thing to do. They feel like they've put in the miles of walking through the snow, so now that's made whatever they do the right thing. And the crime they commit is, aside from being on elder land and taking elk meant for elders, which is essentially taking food off of elders' plates, they stand up on a ridge and they just shoot down into all these brown bodies, and they essentially become, for a moment of recklessness, of thoughtlessness, the cavalry who were mm-hmm. standing up on a ridge above the Blackfeet on January 23rd, 1870, shooting down into us, you know.
Why did you choose to make it around Thanksgiving, this event?
Thanksgiving is always such a complicated holiday, mm-hmm. I think. I mean, for Indians, it's complicated, you know, because we get together like everybody does because we got some time off. But the legend is that it's a time when Indians and colonists came together and celebrated and all that stuff. And, of course, that's just a myth. It's not really what went down as I understand it. But, it's a fraught thing. Like, you see little kids walking down the street with carved construction paper feathers, mm-hmm. you know, from construction paper headbands that they made in school that day. And you realize that a whole other generation is coming up that is being conditioned to kind of commodify natives and mm-hmm. kind of just presume that we're invisible or we don't exist anymore, that it's okay to do that, you know?
Or even kind of Disney-fy in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
My guest is Stephen Graham Jones. The name of his new novel is The Only Good Indians. There's also this really interesting idea, and I read somewhere that it's based somewhat on a true story or a moment in your life where one of the sort of sins of what happened in that shooting is that the meat was not used for food.
Correct. Yeah. In 2007, I guess it was, in November, right around the same time, I was up on the reservation. I got a cow elk, and like I do with all the animals I take, I told her that this is terrible. It's had to happen, but this is how I'm going to give meat to my family. You're going to be put to good use, and I'm not just doing this to do this. I'm doing this for a good purpose. And then, 4 months later, maybe 5 months later, I was suddenly moving from Texas to Colorado, and I couldn't take a freezer full of meat with me. So I had to go up and down the street, knocking on doors, giving away packets of elk meat. And I have no idea what happened to that elk meat. And I spent probably 10 years feeling guilty for that I had made a promise to this elk. And then, as far as I knew, people could have thrown it away as soon as they closed the door. You know, I always felt bad about that.
And that figures prominently in the story. We won't give too much away.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the elk head woman. How did the vision of the elk head woman come together, and what changed about her over your writing process?
In the first part of it, she's possibly real, possibly not mm-hmm. real. In the second part, she's become a lot more real. She's gained some corporality. But as for, you know, where I launch off into elk head woman, for me anyways, I came back from the first Indigenous Comic-Con, which I think must have been in 2017, with a copy of a friend, Elizabeth LaPensee's comic book called Deer Woman, a vignette. It's got this beautiful cover of this woman with a deer head, and I set that by my keyboard because it was just so good to look at, and I can't imagine that wasn't really integral to, mm-hmm. you know, prompting me to kind of monstrify it, you know? I mean, I'm not saying that it's not that deer head woman wasn't already, or Deer Woman isn't already a monster herself of some sort, but I wanted to take it a little further if I could.
As someone who writes horror, when you're in the writing process, when do the moments of horror come? I mean, is it the kind of thing, and I want to give an example of something that happens in the book, mm-hmm. I don't want to give too much away, but the elk mm-hmm. woman just destroys a dog. Mm-hmm. So when you're writing horror, do you have the image of what the violence is and then you put it in the story? Or does the story lead you to this moment?
It's the story leading me to the moment, generally. Mm-hmm. I don't, like, when I was writing this novel, I had no idea I was writing a novel. I was just following a sentence and following a scene. It starts with Lewis. This novel starts with some idiot up on a ladder in his living room trying to fix the light bulb and having forgotten to turn the fan off. And that idiot is me. I was doing that, my wife and I, 2.5 years ago, just moved into a place that with a tall vaulted living room ceiling and a misbehaving light bulb up there. And I was up working on it one day, and I looked down through the blades of that ceiling fan, and I thought, you know, I wonder what rate they're flickering at. I wonder if it's like 26 feet per second like film. And I wonder if that's going to allow me to see something through there. And So I just sat down and I started writing about a guy up on a ladder, and it could have been a story then. And then it got a little longer and it was feeling like a novella. And then it opened up into two more parts and became a novel. And as for the horror parts, yeah, like you're talking about with the dog, that was totally unplanned. I think, and for me, that's what works the best for my writing style anyway, is when I discover things along the way instead of try to sculpt things towards those moments. I think when I sculpt them towards those moments, it feels too stagey. When I discover them in the process, then I think there might be a chance of some surprise for the reader as well.
You know, certain kinds of genres have certain rhythms to them. Mysteries have a certain rhythm. Romances have a certain rhythm. What's part of the rhythm of a horror novel for you?
A big part of the rhythm of a horror novel is dread, and then either a jump scare or some sort of pressure release valve, which is usually of the form of some sort of laugh or joke or, you know, comic punch of some sort. The trick with horror is if you keep escalating the whole time, you really quickly end up at this high screechy plateau where it's all the same. It's just a solid scream the whole way. So you have to go up, like up 10 steps and then down 7 steps and up 10 more steps and down 5 steps. You have to reset constantly because if you don't, then the reader kind of becomes numb to everything that's happening.
My guest is Stephen Graham Jones. We're talking about his new horror novel, The Only Good Indians. Now, part of the real horror is not just the gory stuff, which is gory and cool in its goriness, but it's also the idea that this spirit, this being, is affecting the men psychologically and making them turn against one another and people that they love. Why is that part of this creature's, why is that her aim?
She wants to take from them what's most important to them, the same way they took from her what was most important to her. It's not enough for her just to jump out of a closet and like do some violence to them. That would not be satisfying to her revenge need at all. No, she has to first identify what's most important to them and then methodically take that away and make them culpable for taking it away. That to her is the most effective means of destroying who they are.
The title book refers to this hideous 19th century saying that the only good Indian is a dead Indian. But in the book, you're exploring what it means to be a quote-unquote good Indian. Does that mean not leaving home? Does that mean not marrying a fellow indigenous person? What else did you want to explore about that idea?
I wanted to explore it from as many angles as I could because, yeah, like if it, like Lewis, who feels like he, you know, from one way of looking at it, has all this good Indian blood, and by not having children, is he betraying all his ancestors who somehow made it through the massacres and the plagues and everything? And it turns out, at least the way I think about it, that there's not a single way to be a good Indian. There's 7 million different ways to be a good Indian because that's how many of us there are. Hopefully there'll be more and more too.
The name of the novel is The Only Good Indians. If you like basketball, you'll also really like the novel. Just throw that in at the end for people. My guest is Stephen Graham Jones. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it was wonderful talking to you. Thank you very much.